Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Jack Sasson, Mary Jane Worthen Professor of Jewish Studies and Hebrew Bible, and Professor of Classics, about his forthcoming book, Judges 1 through 12, Volume 1 of a two-volume set for the Anchor Yale Bible Commentary Series. Jack, thanks for being willing to take part in this interview.
Well, it's a pleasure. I hope we'll be able to answer some of the questions that some people have on their minds about the Book of Judges.
Great. You've written commentaries on Ruth and Jonah. Now you're in the midst of a commentary on the Book of Judges. What do you see as the value of scholarly commentary on the Bible?
Well, this is a very interesting question. You know, the Bible is discussed in many forums. Of course, most commonly in the synagogue and the churches, and in meeting rooms where people get together to talk about what the Bible means and try to read it together. But there is another forum, and this is the accent on which we're going to talk about today, and that is the academic forum. How do people deal with a text that comes to us from ancient times? It is a very rich text. It has survived many centuries, but there are still many mysteries to it. Among them is the big question is how did the Bible got to be what it is now? And that is a rather passionate story that has taken many, many years to develop and to be discussed in all its possibilities. A major issue, of course, is who wrote what when. Now, if you are coming from another forum, let us say the religious forum, these issues are not terribly important. You either say that it is God who has inspired people to write exactly what you had in mind, or you can say that, you know, this is a book that has so many values for us today that these issues of who wrote what is not as important as what you do with it. But if you're academic, you do have questions to raise, and the Book of Judges is one of those books, among many others, that has a whole plethora of issues that are begging to be discussed, and I hope we can raise some of them today.
Great. Just sticking with the whole issue of commentaries, we've talked a little bit about this as you've been writing, I think. How does writing a commentary differ from other types of writing? And along with that, how did writing this particular commentary differ from writing the two previous commentaries that you've done?
Oh, these are very, very good and sharp points to make. But first of all, let me just say, I don't just write commentaries.
Right.
I have written other things dealing with the Bible, and my other sort of dossier that I carry with me are all sorts of articles about the ancient Near East, especially about a certain city-state that was destroyed by Hammurabi of Babylon, the famous law code giver, who, before he issued his law code, had time to destroy Mari, apparently. It's not clear exactly how it was destroyed. But in any case, I have written other things on biblical material. But the issue of commentaries is particularly interesting because the process is both centrifugal and centripetal. By centripetal, I mean I look at that text as it has come to our hands after centuries, and I try to see how many ideas it has absorbed from different neighbors, from different cultures around it. So suddenly, when you write a commentary, you have all these oodles of questions that are raised at every chapter, every passage, and each one of them intrigues you, and you want to try to pursue it and find out what has come into it, what ideas have been absorbed, what are its ideas that are purely Hebraic. And it's also centrifugal, because from it, you start thinking about the culture outside. Do they have similar practices? Did they really worry about human sacrifice? What did they do about circumcision? Did they really think that people can go ahead and find themselves husband if they go when a man is sleeping on a little stack of wheat, like in the story of Ruth and Boaz? So you are interested both as a way of linking both of all these materials. Now, as it happens, as you said, I have written two commentaries previous to this one, and this is the third, at least the second and a half, so it's not completed. And the first one, it's interesting, is about the book of Ruth. I wrote it in 79. At that time, it's prehistoric time. That is, we didn't have computers. And every time you had a question, you had to troop down in the library to hope that your library has that specific journal or book. And if it doesn't, if you try to get in those days, I'm not sure whether there was interlibrary loan, but let us say there was, your chances of getting what you want at the time when you need it are not very good. We had a fine library at the University of North Carolina, what it was, but it took a lot of time. The other thing also, the tools you had at your hand, you had dictionary, biblical dictionaries, you had this, and this, but everything was on paper, and everything was slow. The second one I wrote was about the book of Jonah, and about the same size, actually, four chapters, and this time we were in the computer age. I was using a computer, at least trying to use a computer, with all the floppies going in and out and what have you, and with very difficult to maneuver all these word processes. But what was interesting is that you were beginning to get material that you can buy on databases. Mm. In those days, you got the databases on various little things. They were not very enormous with it, but you had some things. And that sort of complicated your effort a bit because you could not escape the fact that you had other things to worry about aside from whether you can make it to the library today or not. And this one here is in the day of the internet. Now, the internet, it's like swimming in an ocean in the sense that everything is available and not everything is trustworthy. Mm. So I would say that in writing the book of Judges, it slowed me down quite a bit. It took me 10 years between the first and second, but it's taken me quite a bit more. Not that I was working with them with it all the time. But the truth of the matter is that it has complicated my life, all this accessible thing. And people like you, Chris, who are there to tell me that, oh my gosh, did you see this software? Did you do this? Did you do this? It made life a bit more complicated. But nonetheless, it's enriched it. There is no excuse right now not to use an item because interlibrary loan brings it to you right away. Mm. So I don't know whether I want to go into it, but truth to tell is the internet is not making life any easier. So who knows how long Volume 2 will take it before it comes out, and who knows what other discoveries is going to come out computer-wise that will slow me down even more.
Right. All right. I wanted to turn to, actually, the book, your book and the book of Judges, and ask first a general question. Since the book is called the Book of Judges, at least in English, what is a judge?
Well, one thing I can tell you, it's not like Judge Judy or Judge Scalia. Mm. This is not people who are robed in black and sit in the corner, or even the people who come and make decision about who wins in a beauty contest. It's a judge like that. It's a very complicated issue, and the reason it's complicated is because you can say more about what a judge is by how they behave in the biblical text rather than by a label. It's not like you are applying for a position judge, and you say you make your candidacy. The Hebrew word is shofet. In Semitic languages, the root shapatu or shofet means someone who makes a decision. Exactly what kind of a decision is itself in question. In the book of Judges, strangely enough, in the book of Judges, the only person who is called a shofet, that is a judge, double quote, is God. No one else is called that. They use the verb lishpot, which means to judge, but it does not apply to the person. It could be just a peculiarity, but that is so, and that we have noted. We have to note it. Now, what's interesting is that when you look at the book of Judges, different personality who are considered judges operated slightly differently, but among other things, they needed to be leaders of troops, because that's their main task, usually to shoo away, to get rid of an enemy that has been harassing Israel. And then after that, they had to govern. And so they could be governing. I don't know whether people brought their problems. They probably did. Why not? Like Deborah, she did sat in the tree and heard them. But they did govern. But the most important thing in the book of Judges is the shofet has to have been selected by God. And in one way or another, the text tells us that on them fell the Spirit of God. We can discuss it perhaps later what it actually means. It's a rather complicated problem. But that is so. So you have these three things they have to have. In the stories that we have about the judges, none of them goes more beyond getting rid of the enemy. Once they get rid of the enemy, the writer tend to lose interest in them, and he says they judged for a certain number of years, and that was that, until a new enemy arises. So basically, it is not a completely developed notion about a judge. What we can do is, if we go to outside sources, let us say the sources from Mesopotamia, from Mari, a city that was destroyed by Hammurabi around 1760 BC or so, when we see the word Shapitum, which is equivalent to the Hebrew shofet, those people are really basically in charge of running a province. If you want to have military leader, you need to go to someone called a merchum, which is equivalent to our Hebrew ro'e, that is someone who pastures in the sense of taking care of its military troop. So if you add these two together, you can have an equivalent. But none of them has the divine aspect, divine selection aspect that you have in the biblical text.
You chose to interpret the, and I'm quoting from you here, the Hebrew version of Judges, the book, as received in our days. And my question for you is, how would you characterize this version of Judges over against other versions? And what are some of the reasons for and the consequences of making the choice of the text that you
okay,
did.
Okay, now you don't mean a different version. You mean the difference between the commentaries to the book of Judges or what?
No, Greek, you know, used.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, this in itself, when I said that I am using the Hebrew version of the book of Judges, there could be a slight polemic here.
Okay.
The Hebrew Bible that we have today, people don't know it perhaps, but it is a complicated little collection of material, and over time all sorts of difficulty entered it or were resolved by the various people who had to deal with it. Now, this is, I'm speaking as a person who studies it academically. If you are a person of faith, all this thing is meaningless and it's not worth going into. But when scholars deal with the book of Judges as an example of how to treat it, they face difficulties. As I said, some words are impossible. They occur only once. We don't know what they mean. Some passages that don't seem to be quite clear exactly what is happening there. Some portion seems to have come from somewhere else, and they don't seem to fit the passage by itself. So at that point, if you are a translator and a commentator to the Bible, you start tearing at your hair. So what are the avenues open to you? Well, the first thing is you have comparative Semitics. That is, you have studied Semitic languages like Hebrew, and you say, well, there are words that are very similar to the Hebrew word here, and they occur in Akkadian, they occur in Ethiopic, they occur in Aramaic, and maybe they mean this or that. So you bring in meanings from other Semitic languages. But most commonly what people do is look how people in the past have translated the Hebrew into other languages, prominently Greek, because that was done in the 2nd, 3rd century BC, even earlier than our earliest copy of the Hebrew text that we have. So there is a tendency to think that the Greek itself may have had a better text of the Hebrew because some passages are so much clearer there. It is possible that this is so, but I think my task is not to write a commentary of the book of Judges or of the best book of Judges that we could have, but I write a commentary at the book of Judges that we now have, the one that you can go and buy in any bookstore from a Hebrew bookseller, That does not mean you ignore the others. You must pay attention. But what you do when you deal with the others is say to yourself, it is possible that they had a better text. It is possible. Why not? But it's also possible that they also pull their hair out. They couldn't understand what it is. And they couldn't do it to their readers not to make sense. So they translate it in a way that makes sense. Mm-hmm. We do that all the time. I must tell you, if someone asks me to deal with the book of Hosea, I'll tell them, take an English translation. They have already worked for you, and they have translated it in a way you can understand it, because the Hebrew is almost impossible in some places, and so forth. So they have done their work for them. What I say when I deal with the book of Judges as received in our days, what I really mean is I'm going to try as hard as possible to deal with what I have, but I will tell you what other people have said. But what other people have said or other translation have said, that is part of the commentary section, not part of the text, how it was. Does that make sense?
Yes, okay, yes. That's a great answer.
Good, thank you.
You've already mentioned that what you're doing is an academic academic exercise, but it's focused on, it's in the academy. You're working out of the academy, and therefore you are interested in some of the approaches that have been used throughout history, academic approaches to the biblical text. And you mention, you actually survey several of them in the introduction, source criticism, redaction criticism, and such. And as you comment on various passages in the book, you mention some of these approaches, but you don't seem to be wedded to any particular approach. How would you characterize your approach to the Book of Judges?
Well, I'm wedded to a wonderful woman who is a better scholar than I am. Her name is Diane. But yes, this is also a very good and sharp point to deal with. You know, over the years, people have, over 2,000 years, maybe even longer, people have dealt with the Book of Judges. Perhaps not exactly the one that we have today, as we had said before, but nonetheless, they have to deal with it. And they had theories about how this worked, how that worked. For example, how to explain Jephthah, how to explain Deborah, who was Deborah, whatever. They had theories. So what I think when I'm doing a commentary, aside from trying to explain how the Hebrew text, as I see it, meant for its time, or may have meant for readers over various period of times, one of the things that I want to do also is to use it to engage in conversations with all those generations of scholars and people who have looked at the book. Because basically when it come right down to it, the study of the Hebrew Bible is the most humanistic of enterprises. Now, I don't want it to be misunderstood. What I mean by that is that you have over 2,000 years of people poring over the same text. And each one of them had something to say. And each one of them had something he or she saw that we did not see. Now, I started my story from the early 19th century. Why? Because that's when the academic study of the Bible really began in earnest. But over time, people have had many things to say about it. And I tried to collect it, what they thought about it this time and that time. Now, the thing that I tried to point out in my introduction is that if you look over the 200, 250 years of discussions about this book of Judges, how people have seen it, it was not random. It developed in a rather expected sequence because people deal with a biblical text according to the needs of their own time. Hmm. People do not just enter the biblical text, especially in academia. Again, do not deal with the biblical text because they are going to make sure that this is the certainty of what the text was. Of course, they may say it, but in fact, they're trying to answer issues that are raised by their own day. This is why you do not have people raising issues about feminist constructions in the book of Judges until rather modern time, except for two occasions in the 19th century, when the Grimke sister before the Civil War, and then when Elizabeth Cady Stanton after the Civil War tried to raise the same issue, but it was not done in academia. Their voices, their words, were part of the popular discussion of the time, but did not enter into biblical scholarship until today. So what I try to show is that the book of Judges is one example of biblical text that is constantly being rethought in order to answer issues particular to their time. So I say to myself, Sasson, Jack Sasson, do you want to add one more notion about what it is when you know that in another 20, 30 years it's not going to mean much at all? Or it's going to mean something historiographically. And I say to myself, I really don't need that. I really want to spend more of my time or my energy or my invention or whatever imagination not to create another theory of how the biblical book of Judges got to be and from where it came from and how there are tons of them already by the hundreds, all of them wonderful, all of them terrific, but all of them having the long life of a flea, you know, the life, what is it, the life
lifespan
of a flea, you know, I mean, they don't last that long because people have different issues, so I don't. Yes, it is so if people ask me, Sasson, what do you think about the book of Judges? I said, what do you think about the book of Judges? I want to try to understand how it works. What do words mean? I don't really care how they came to be, although I care, but I really don't think that I can add much more about that.
Right.
Okay, great.
You've already hinted in one of your answers to, in a way that's connected to this question, but I wanted to have you talk about it a little bit more extensively. The ancient Near East clearly plays a role not only in your commentary, but as you've been saying, it plays a role in, I mean, it's very central to your scholarship in general. You refer frequently to texts and languages of the peoples in ancient Israel's vicinity, but it seems to me that your use of these texts and languages is fairly measured, at least compared to how the ancient Near East was used in biblical studies, certainly in the late 19th, early 20th century, even mid-20th century, where, you know, people were constantly making all sorts of archaeological discoveries and trying to connect them in some way to the biblical text, to ancient Israel. How do you find the artifacts of ancient Israel's neighbors, far and near, to be useful in understanding the Book of Judges?
Well, that is again another very interesting issue, and you'll permit me if I take a second
sure.
To sharpen it a bit.
Sure.
Again, when the academic studies of the Bible began, at that time there was only the Bible. There were no documents and material that came from the world from around the Hebrew Bible. There was Greece, of course, but it was not regarded as being immediately of consequence because it was slightly later and a different configuration of people. So from the beginning, when scholarship started looking at the Hebrew Bible, it was of the essence to make a statement about it that is more than just, let's say, pious.
Hmm.
And one of the things that was important in those days when people were discussing history, discussing the past, is how do you arrive at a clearer, a more truthful version of what really happened. So in those days, the idea was if you have only one document, you have no documents because one message, one messenger, one version in itself cannot allow you to create history. You need to be able to bring together 2, 3, 4 and compare them, contrast them, see how they deal with the same issue. For example, if you want to find out about the Obamacare, you can't just take the statement of Obama. You've got to take what other people have said about it and try to reconstruct something. Okay. So from that was developed the famous documentary hypothesis, where they look at the internally to the Bible and they took out from it 4 different strands, which they said if we can just put them together, it will tell us how at least Israel thought about its past. It may not tell us about history's past, but Israel's past, but how Israel. All that was wonderful, and that's when you had in the 19th century the famous Wellhausen and the documentary hypothesis. Problem is then doesn't sell well with everyone because some people say, well, you know, I mean, if we're going to start taking the Bible and breaking it into segments and then start putting one against the other, where is the Word of God? Where is the truth? Where is that? Luckily for those people, something has happened in the 19th century, and what happened is that they have been able to make the ancient people talk again. We were able to decipher Egyptian, Akkadian, Hittite, Ugaritic, and all these other languages, and suddenly the ancient people who were neighbors to Israel started talking. And once they started talking, wow, suddenly we had kings from these texts that says, look at the Bible, it's all true. You have Sennacherib, you have Ashurbanipal, you have king this, king that. All these people mentioned in the Bible, it's all true. But then also you had stories that were translated, for example, a story about the flood in the Babylonian material, and suddenly people said to themselves, oh my gosh, the Hebrews were not alone. They were thinking about similar things. So suddenly by the late 19th century, everything got complicated. And it got complicated to the point in which how much of it do you use in order to ascertain whether the Hebrews were unique? Were they different? Were they telling the truth? Were they telling a version of the truth? All these things became very, very big problems. But one interesting thing is how various groups started using the translations that we have from the ancient world. And if you want, you add archaeology, because archaeology may not be the recovery of words that people wrote, but it's the recovery of artifacts that people use. So in some ways, it's another version of the type of material that you put together. The problem is that in archaeology, you can see what people used to eat, where they sat, how they slept, how many rooms they had, but you cannot really say who was doing what and for what reason they used that and not the others. You needed someone to enunciate choices, and that's where you go to texts. All right. So in this particular period of time, let us say in the 1920s, even earlier, 1890s it begins already, people were starting to use the ancient Near Eastern material to do two things. One is to try to authenticate what has happened. That is to say, look at the material from the Bible and compare it to the material from the ancient world, and you will see that this probably happened, this probably did not, and so forth. But they also were trying to see what kind of life did they have, what kind of feeling did they have about how they run their religious life, how they run their actual life. So use the material to reconstruct life as it was happening. All this was nice and well until the 20th century, when after World War I, the Americans started entering the fight. Although the British and the Germans were having this discussion about how to authenticate biblical statement, the patriarchs, Moses, and so forth, the Americans did it with a vengeance. Hmm. Because for in America, there was a tendency to take much more seriously the veracity of the Bible. The reason for it is interesting. It is possible because American history in itself was written as a form of biblical history. Hmm. For example, you had people who were asked to leave the world to come here and establish a new Zion. They met with Canaanites, Indians, I guess, and they vanquished them and took over their place. And then God gave them the Torah, which is the Constitution. And when they didn't listen, they split into two nations. And so there is a tendency in biblical, among American scholarship, to see nothing implausible about biblical narratives. Hmm. So they had a higher stake in trying to show historicity, hmm. that is, prove that everything in the Bible, at least after the patriarchs, hmm. no one argued, very few scholars argued for the authenticity of Adam and Eve and things like Cain and Abel, although they said parabolically it's better than truth, you know, because what they sell is a much more interesting version of what reality is. Anyway, okay, so here we come, and in the 1920s and 30s, three major places, four now, maybe five, major places were found. One was Ugarit on the seacoast of Syria, where now they're killing each other, unfortunately. This is the place where the Alawi actually live, near Ugarit. Hmm. And the other one was Nuzi, which was a place in Iraq, in Kurdistan, where you have close to the area where the Kurds are today. And the third one was Mari, a city on the Euphrates, not too far from the modern Syrian-Iraqi border. These three, what makes them different is that they came from cultures of the second millennium BC, where people thought the Hebrew lived. Hmm. And during the 1950s, especially 40s and 50s, an enormous amount of discussion was carried on, mostly in a debate between the American scholars, Albright and his school, and the Germans, who were still following, not quite, but in some ways developing on Wellhausen, that is, you can use biblical material internally to reconstruct what the Hebrews were thinking about their past, versus the Americans who were saying, no, we can deal with the past. The Book of Judges was one of those books that was a center of the deep fight. Hmm. Because everything about the Book of Judges seemed plausible. You know, I mean, you have Hebrews trying to carve up a place for themselves. They had just left Egypt, and so forth. So whereas the fight was to be about patriarchs, it was also about Moses, it was also about Joshua, it was also about... All this was carried out in the 1950s. So I don't know where I'm going, heading with that, but the point that I want to say is that people have used ancient Near Eastern material for a very long time to authenticate historicity, that is, to authenticate the plausibility of what happened in the Bible. I don't use it like that, not because I don't think it is historical. That is not even an issue with me. What is important for me is to try to show that the ancient Near Eastern material are homologous. That is, they are part of the same accretion of thoughts about how people live and how people operate, so that when I look at Mari text, it gives me insight how to understand certain texts better in the Book of Judges, not to say that they are from the same mm-hmm. time, but mm-hmm. to say that the culture is somewhat similar. An example, maybe I'll say it now.
Sure.
And that is the story of Aksa.
Hmm.
Now, it's a little small episode, and not too many people would probably remember it, but in the first chapter of the book of Judges, we have all sorts of things that are being told. One of them is that a man named Caleb, who was a very important dignitary, had promised to whoever conquers a certain city his daughter Aksa. And the text very shortly tells us that as he was leading her and she's riding a donkey, she asked him a question and he answers a question, answer her in a question. And the end of it, she ends up gaining a certain area of Negev land that she ends up getting. It's a difficult story, but it's a charming story. What I found interesting is the role of Aksa. What is her business arguing with her dad? What is she telling him? In fact, there are all sorts of somewhat scandalous translation of the same passages. I will not go into them, but if anyone has access to the New English Bible, just look under Judges 1:18 or something and see how they translated, and you will be shocked because people found, you see, now I'm going to sell the book of NLB. But the point of it is that what is going on itself is very interesting. And if you look at the Mari text, you have a slew of material, living material, that is, exchanges of letters, exchanges of diplomatic couriers and so forth, that gives you insight of what people who were important people did with their daughters, among them the kings, what they did with their princesses. And almost all of them, I must say, sadly enough, the daughters of a king named Zimri-Lim, almost all of them were used as trophy wives to give to vassals and to buy their loyalty.
Hmm.
Not all of them. Some of them became high priestesses and so on, but a number of them. We have lots of information about how they married, what happened to them and so forth. But what's interesting is that a number of these daughters became incredibly unhappy. And they will write their father, please take me back home, otherwise I'm going to jump off a roof and die. But others were very clever. They took their husband's side and tried to demand from their father all sorts of advantages for their husband. So I would put Aksa in that category and try to understand the type of cleverness that entered in the story. Now, if you know that her husband, Othniel, became a judge later on, that is useful to know too. But it's a small little paradigm, more or less, of stories that can be perhaps better explained when you look at the ancient Near Eastern material.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. I don't know whether to ask you this question or not, since you've talked a little bit about history. But maybe I will anyway. Since you have brought up the whole issue of history, historicity, what really happened and such, and you've mentioned how, to a degree, how Judges has played into that, and you've kind of said that you really don't. You're not really that interested in talking about Judges.
I'm not invested.
You're not
interested. May not
okay.
be correct. I'm not invested. So, if someone tells me it is this period, fine with me.
Okay.
I don't fight
yeah.
it.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll just leave that
as the answer
to that question, and we'll move into actually looking at since you've provided something of a segue into actually looking at the Book of Judges with this discussion of Aksa. Obviously, we're not going to have time to go through the entire commentary, and that's the purpose for the audience to get the commentary when it's available. But
yes, please buy it.
But I did want to touch on some of the narratives in the book and some themes that might be illustrative of the larger volume. And one that I particularly wanted to ask you about was the story of Ehud. You have disagreements with a lot of interpretations of this particular story. both in terms of actually what's happening in the story and then in terms of how to read it. And I wonder if you could, after perhaps giving a brief summary of the story, talk a little bit about how you read this particular text as sort of an example of the kinds of things that you're doing in the commentary.
The story of Ehud occurs in chapter 3 of Judges. He comes next after Othniel, which was given to us in very few verses and gives us a paradigm of what a perfect relationship between a judge and what he's supposed to do in a very short phrase. Now comes Ehud. It's a messy chapter.
Hmm.
It begins by telling us that once again the Hebrews have done wrong, and of course God is very upset with them, he's very angry, and he sends a king named Eglon, whose name means calf, calf, C-A-L-F.
Mm-hmm.
Woo! All right. He sent a king named Eglon to beat them up and capture them, and they were under his control for many years. And then comes Ehud, who as a savior, Moshiach is the Hebrew word for the Hebrew. He is, the text tells us he's a Benjaminite, that is from the tribe of Benjamin, which actually means the son of the right. Right, I mean, if you face the sun, the right would be the south, and that is the name of a tribe, Benjamin, meaning the sons of the south. But it's an occasion to use a pun, because they tell you his Iter Yad Yamino is the Hebrew, which actually means he has taken control, he has trained his right hand. Okay, so he is a Benjaminite, the son of the right, and so there's a pun here going on. Okay. He comes and tells the king Eglon, I have a message from God. Eglon says to everyone, leave. And when he leaves him alone, he stabs him in the belly, murders him, finds a way to escape, and rallies the Hebrews, and they beat up on the Moabite, clear up the place, and he rules for many, many years. Is that
Yeah, I'm hoping that people who are listening have some recollection of the story, but I think that would help.
Well, they haven't made an HBO feature of it, so...
But it sounds like it could be something.
Yes, all right. Okay. So, up until relatively recently, when that story is read, it was read as a good comeuppance. Here is a person who's beating up on the Hebrews, and he gets his just dessert. No one liked the notion of murdering. Voltaire especially was shocked that you would make a hero out of a person who assassinates a traitor. Not a traitor, excuse me.
Tyrant?
Terrorist, you know,
something like that.
Like this at all and so forth like that. But generally, most people, tyrannicide is acceptable if the tyrant is a tyrant. So, All right. But come 20th century sensibilities, people are not very happy with that because of the rather brutal way in which this king is killed, who, after all, when Ehud told him, I have a message from God for you, stands up.
Hmm.
And in fact, you know, in rabbinic lore, he is an ancestor of Ruth, the great Ruth, the grandmother, great-grandmother the great-grandmother of David. So basically, I mean, he deserves better than that. Huh? All right. So they took this story and turned it into a farce, into a satire, and they want to understand it as a parody of some sort. And they say Eglon, meaning fatted calf, and the text tells us that he was bari in Hebrew, which people translate as fat, and every time a translation comes in, he gets fatter. I don't know. I mean, they just glorify in his fatness, and they say, look, he's a fatted calf who's going to be slaughtered. It's very funny, har har. And then after that, people start saying, well, you know, Ehud, he is left-handed, and everyone knows, I don't know how they know it, but everyone knows that left-handed people are tricky. Moreover, everyone knows left-handed people are homosexual. I have no idea how they come up with things like that, but the people have said it in the scholarship. It's unfortunate, but it's said. right? And so forth. And when he tells Eglon and this, and he says, leave us alone, it's because Eglon wants to have it. And people take the knife and all that. It's just absolutely horrible. Okay, so my question about it here is first to reconstruct the story and try to point out how the notion about the fatted calf is really inserted by us. The notion about what kind of character Ehud is inserted by us. But even more so, you will see in most scholarly discussions about the scene of how he was assassinated, that he was sitting, of all things, on the toilet. You will find it everywhere. And I said to myself, where the heck did they get this toilet from? How would you like to have a palace in which in the middle of the palace sits a king on his toilet? It just makes no sense. And in fact, he stood up before he got murdered. What is happening here? It is obvious to me, as time progressed, that this is a story that people don't feel comfortable with, and they have turned it into a comic piece. And I say to myself, if they do that to this story about a person who gets rid of a tyrant, what would they do with Yael? How is it pronounced in English? Jael, who murdered Sisera. Why don't they make a farce out of it? But they never do. So the question becomes, what are they trying to avoid? And for me, the pleasure of biblical reading is not, or at least of the pleasure of understanding biblical text is not to distort them into something that would make you comfortable. Because there is enough of comfortable passages in the Bible, but there are many, many, many segments that raise issues that you need to think about. So that's what I do. I try to show how that story must be understood, exactly how he kills him and why he kills him, where was he, how does he escape. I try to clarify all that without insinuating all sorts of comical aspects of the narrative. I have no doubt that ancient Hebrews, when they heard the story, they thought that this is something where God tried to save him, even though the approach he took was not the most happy thing. Actually, what's interesting is up until the 20th century, you hardly know no Jew, because someone will tell me that in the 14th century it happened. No Jew called his child Ehud. It's a name that was avoided. Exactly like no one named their children, no Jewish person anyway, Esau. These are the names that you avoid, except beginning with the return in the 20th century to Palestine. And so suddenly we had Ehud everywhere, Ehud Barak, Ehud Ben Dov, Ehud everywhere, you know. So suddenly the name is back again, which in itself tells you that people have made their peace with that story. And I think we should too.
Okay. Another, this is more sort of thematic, and you've talked a little, you've talked about Aksa, and you just mentioned Yael. You mention that, and then you follow through, and when you're looking at particular passages, that women play pretty significant roles in the Book of Judges, to the extent that some think a woman was authorially involved in some places.
And they should.
So we meet, you know, we meet Aksa, we meet Deborah and Yael, we meet Sisera's mother, we meet the woman who drops the millstone on Abimelech's head, Jephthah's daughter and her companions, and there may be somebody that I'm forgetting. Of course, all of these women are doing different kinds of things, but is there anything that we can say about how women are represented in the Book of Judges, at least to the point that you've written?
Well, you did forget.
Okay.
You forgot Delilah.
Oh, well, Delilah, but she's not in the section.
Yeah, but she's in Judges.
She's in Judges, yes, but I want you to...
And by forgetting Delilah, you did something even more unforgivable. You forgot Hedy Lamarr. I mean, as a child growing up, seeing Samson and Delilah, who cared about Victor Mature and his biceps? It's Hedy Lamarr that was the most attractive. Yes. In any case, so you forgot about her. And in some ways, actually, Delilah is delightful because she plays almost a mirror image of Yael.
Hmm.
Yael is a heroine for Hebrew. She herself may not have been a Hebrew, mm-hmm. but she's a... Because she killed the tyrant who was harassing and doing all sorts of nasty things to the Hebrews. Whereas Delilah, if I were a Philistine, she would be my ideal. Look at what she did. Now, in biblical lore, one of the most wonderful things is, you know, we always talk about how the Hebrews were male-centered and their God is wrongly understood as a male and all this business. But in fact, the juiciest stories, the best roles are given to women. Women are there to solve problems that men cannot get out of.
Mm.
They just don't know how to get out of, and they have the women who are there to solve them. And you have very strong personalities there. You can't get anyone stronger than Eve. My gosh, she sets the whole human... the whole human descent, just purely on her strength of character in which she argued and she did her thing with the snake. People say, she's failed, but she did not. She grasped what the whole issue was about, and that is to have wisdom, to have independence, and not to be depending on someone who keeps them in a nice, happy, Eden-like world. So, okay, but each one of them is a major character. Sarah and Rebecca, these are very strong personality. In the book of Judges, you have personality like that, and some of them are given more room to develop than others. Like Aksa gets a very small little role. And some of them get roles that are the opposite of what you think is a role. For example, in the later part of the book of Judges, in the chapters that I do not comment yet on, there is this horrible story about a concubine who is murdered. Now, you may say this is a horrible story. Yes, but it actually ends up telling you about a state of mind that was unacceptable. So they become there a vehicle to tell us something about what the Hebrews were horrified by.
Mm.
Yes, it's a terrible story, but the point of it is very important in the development of narratives about how things develop there. All right. So in the book of Judges, you have many women. Deborah is very great. But if you take, for example, just chapter 5 as an example. Chapter 5 is the famous Song of Deborah. It was preceded by chapter 4, of course, which is a story about what happened with Deborah as a narrative, as a story. But in the song, everything about what has happened there is structured such that you see the importance of not just of women, but of motherhood.
Mm.
For example, Deborah is the mother of Israel, and she more or less appears at the beginning of the thing. At the end, you have the mother of Sisera, who, by the way, Sisera is not a person that I would want to consider a hero, but his mother is a true mother. It does not matter that her son is a Al Capone type. She still loves him. She still cares about him. And that's what motherhood is about, someone who ignores our foible, but at the same time realizes that there is the bonds between children and mothers. So it's important. So she is at the end of the story. And in the middle of all things, we have a listing of tribes. People have said that the tribes are mentioned there. Some of them are because they joined the fight and others didn't and so forth. Some people say that they became from this geography, the other. But in fact, if you follow it, they follow exactly the listing of tribe as told to us in the book of Genesis, how they were born to which mother.
Hmm.
So first you have the tribes of Rachel, then the tribe of Leah, and then you have the tribes of the two concubines. So the whole chapter is organized around the notion of motherhood, but also of women. And you say to yourself, what would they do that for? One answer would be, well, maybe it's a woman who put it finally together. It's possible. I don't know. There's no way of telling you. But the other thing also is because through that song about the greatness of God and how he can give delivery to human beings, they are also subtly telling us that women are really participating as creator of that type of a spirit. So in some ways or another, that chapter highlights women in a way that you don't see elsewhere. Hmm. They don't give him name, but the structure in itself is amazing. The Bible really is, if anyone finds in it rather objectionable things about how women are treated, it's true, you know, women are not given voices and so on. But everything about the Bible is trying to tell you that women are a major organizing principle for everything that was Hebraic. Thank you.
One other question about this portion of the commentary. You mentioned several times ways in which God and humans communicate in the Book of Judges. It's a fairly important theme that seems to come through many times. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. How does Judges approach the whole human-divine communication issue, and whether that's distinctive in some way in terms of the Hebrew Bible as a whole?
Yes and no at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrews are no different from other Near Eastern folks that have developed a way from which to receive communication from God.
Hmm.
In the ancient Near East, people had a great variety of ways. They can go to hepatoscopy, which is to inspect the liver. You open it up and you look inside and it gives you signs. You look at the birds, how they're flying. You look at this, you look at that. But also in the ancient Near East, they had three or four major modes that were also known to the Hebrews. One of them was using lots.
Mm-hmm.
In Hebrew, they called Urim and Tumim. You find them on the shield of Yale University. They are there. Not that they know everything there, but who knows. In any case. So the other thing is dreams.
Hmm.
Dreams. People get dreams. The story of Joseph could not be understood without the role of dreams in it all, in how it is unfolding and what have you. And then you have prophets. Sometimes instead of prophets, they will be called messengers. Sometimes they'll be called angels, malach. But basically these, they have no opinion of their own. They are just reporting God's word. In the book of Judges, you find some of each. What's interesting in the book of Judges is that outside of the book of Genesis, you don't find the way God and human being deal with each other in as anthropomorphic way as you find in Judges. Gideon is absolutely amazing. He is a skeptic, and as a result, God has to work harder to persuade him than anyone else in the whole Bible, including Abraham.
Hmm.
God appears to him, and Gideon, because he's skeptical, plays almost with him, forcing him to reveal himself. And the biblical text begin by telling us it's an angel, but soon enough, it started sometimes calling him angel, sometimes calling him God, back and forth, as if it didn't make a difference. And then at other times, you have all sorts of testing. God tests Gideon, and Gideon tests God. They are constantly going back and forth at each other. For example, Gideon is not sure about anything, so he asked God to do all these little tricks with the fleece. You know, it's not worth going into the detail of how it is, but basically he uses a fleece as a way of trying to force God to prove that he means something to him. Another time, when he doesn't trust that he could win victory, he has God send him into the camp of the enemy, the Midianites, and there God sends a dream, which is interpreted by a Midianite to make very complicated stories of how things are. So what you have here is a remarkably, I would say, primitive double quote in the sense of, that's what makes biblical literature at once amazing, because at once primitive sometimes, but at the same time just totally exhilarating. This, and they sometimes occur both of them together. There's something about biblical literature that is different from the literature that I'm used to from other parts of the world. Well, okay, so you have all these testing back and forth in the story of Gideon's, not the most pleasant way of thinking about God sometimes or about a leader, but by the end of it, what happens in the story is the important thing. With all this testing back and forth, for example, at one time God makes him give up all the soldiers and only be left with 300 by this very fancy little way of lapping or not lapping water. I don't know if it's worth going into. But the thing about it is you have 300 people. The whole point of it is God ends up creating a leader. This person, is, by the time you finish with these things, he is sure of himself. He knows how to lead. He knows what is right. He knows what is wrong. He has slowly but surely taken a poltron, perhaps, and made him into a full-blooded, heroic figure. That's what you hope every person ends up being. If you are a Hebrew, you want your children, whatever the reason, to end up having self-confidence. And he does that. And so in these stories here, you can read them as true or untrue, whatever, it's not worthwhile. But the point of them is that they're building character. And you cannot beat them in the way that they are told to us. You arrive to them whether you want to or not.
A last question. I kind of hesitate to ask this because maybe you were hoping this would be a surprise when the person gets to this particular portion in your commentary, but you argue towards the end of the commentary, well, actually it's before we get to the story of Jephthah, but you argue that a fairly significant change takes place in God's attitude toward Israel, and we're not even halfway through the book yet. At this point,
not toward Israel, but toward the way Israel manages itself.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Could you talk about that change in God's attitude toward the way Israel manages itself, and maybe talk a little bit about what that might make the rest of the way that the rest of Judges, I mean, kind of segue into the second volume, make the rest of Judges function, the way the rest of Judges works as a narrative? How does that change impact the rest of the book? This is kind of asking you to talk about something that may not be completely done yet.
It's fine, it's fine. Well, you know, the Hebrew is following a trajectory. The trajectory begins when God brings Abraham into the promised land. Tribes develop, end up in bondage, come out, conquer the land under Joshua. Now, once they conquer the land under Joshua, they're still tribes. Tribes have a way of breaking up. Tribes have a way out of fighting each other rather than anyone else. So in the book of Judges, we have these examples in which God finds a way in which he forces the tribe to come together. Even though there are local stories, each one of them, the notion is always Israel is at stake here. But we know what's going to come ahead. At least you and I know. What's going to come ahead is David. What's going to come ahead before David is Saul. So we're going to have kingship. Kingship is something different. We almost nibble at it when we come to Gideon, because Gideon people ask him to be not a king. They ask him to be a, what is the term that they use there? Not shofet. They ask him to be, I'll think of the name, Mashal. Yeah, Moshel.
Moshel.
To be a Moshel, which is not quite king.
Hmm.
But he could have been. And in fact, his son calls is named Avimelech. This is a name that Gideon calls his son. Avimelech means my father is king. Hmm. So basically, kingship is arriving, but it's not quite yet. But once you come to Gideon, already that whole system of having judges seemed to no longer be working well because it keeps on repeating. How often can you have a judge? You get exhausted by it every time God has to think of creating a new one. And there's never a discussion about why isn't it that I don't choose a judge and tell him, okay, from now on you choose your own follower. This is what kingship is about. It's a judge who can have his children take over.
Hmm.
But it doesn't come to that. So the book of Judges shows us the problem that occurs constantly. And when we come just before Gideon, there is a famous scene, before Jephthah, there is a famous scene in which the Hebrews had made a terrible error, and God sent their enemies. And it's always the usual way. And then the Hebrews say, we believe, come, let's rescue us. But at that time, the God says, I've had enough of it. I'm not going to do it. And they said, but please. And the text says us, "Batikzar nafsho ba'amal Yisrael," which literally, it's been mistranslated in my opinion, but the people translated, and he had pity on them again. But it's not what the Hebrew has. What the Hebrew has, he lost patience with them, and he told them, go to hell. Excuse me, not hell, but go to Sheol. That's the Hebrew word for the Sheol. He doesn't want to participate anymore. The story that we have following is the story of Jephthah.
Hmm.
Jephthah is not a story of a judge that God chose to beat Amalek or whatever. It is the story of how a young man manages to get for himself all the major elements that makes a judge a judge.
Hmm.
He deals with his own people in order for them to make him a katzin, which means a military leader. They treat with them to make him a rosh, which means a governor. He even finds a way to make God give him, you know. But basically, he has finagled it.
Hmm.
And Jephthah, with Jephthah, we have an example of how that system is broke. It's not going to work anymore. And in fact, Jephthah rules for only 6 years. And in fact, Jephthah ends with the most monstrous story of them all. That is how he sacrifices his own daughter, not something that people will think is a very dignified way or a very reasonable way of acting. And after that, we have the story of Samson. Samson himself never does what a judge is. He's supposed to be judging a nation. In fact, all he judges is his incapacity to keep himself away from Hedy Lamarr. It's just totally ridiculous. And the story is repeated twice. He rules for 20 years. The end of chapter 16, he's dealing with a crazy woman from Timnah chapter. So basically, it's not the typical. So things had to end.
Hmm.
The rest of the book of Judges doesn't deal much after Samson doesn't deal much with Samson. But we know that it's not over because in the book of Samuel, Eli, the person who sponsored Samuel, is a judge. And also we have Samuel, a judge. And amazingly enough, both of them think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with them choosing their own children to become judges. So the whole system had completely broken up.
Hmm.
And it is at that point that despite the complaint of Samuel, we have the story that God says, okay, get yourself a king. Realize that you're not going to do well. You're going to have problems. But go ahead. And eventually even God gets used to it because the greatest one of them all is David. And he loves him forever, despite everything.
Hmm.
So basically the narratives are driving us through the whole sequence, passages. Mm-hmm. So we go through many, many passages. It is, as someone says, a biography of God. It is a biography of the Hebrew people. But most of all, it's a story of a relationship that always couldn't really get itself right. Until finally, God more or less gives up and allows the Hebrew people to act like any other nation and to have kings. Hmm. And that's where Judges is heading. Hmm.
Jack, thank you. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Again, I've been talking with Jack Sasson, Mary Jane Worthen Professor of Jewish Studies and Hebrew Bible and Professor of Classics, about his forthcoming book, Judges 1 through 12, Volume 1 of a two-volume set for the Anchor Yale Bible Commentary Series. If you have any questions about this conversation or any comments that you'd like to make, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.